Hey, man. How are you guys doing? I don't mean to be sexist. Hey, girls. I mean, ladies. Women. Persons of whatever you're supposed to call them. Feminine. Persuasion. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. For all of y'all, the ladies and the gentlemen. And everybody in between. Everybody who ever switched from one to the other. Whatever. Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show, where I try to teach you what I'm learning about the evil empire that is the U.S. government. Most I interview journalists about what they know about what's going on around here. Along those lines, today I'm going to be talking with Greg Grandin, author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. If only I'd had time to read the book between when I got it and when I got to interview the guy. But I did read his Tom Dispatch article. Henry of Arabia. Oh no, not Henry of Arabia. Oh yeah. You know about how many Cambodians Henry Kissinger got killed, but now it's time to learn a little bit more about his role in the various crises in the Persian Gulf. It'll be great. And then also, Nathaniel Penn is going to be on the show, and his thing is not so much about foreign policy, although it's still about the empire, if you ask me. Another Waco massacre. This one, not too much unlike the first in the way of basically just being a turkey shoot. Bunch of innocent people slaughtered by cops with high-powered rifles. And, you know, I should be careful with my first and second, because there very well could have been other Waco massacres that I don't know about before 1993 or since. So, anyway, you know about this. It's the biker shootout thing. Man, the Black Lives Matter people should have been all over that. Our friends and allies, the bikers of Texas, innocent people, gunned down by the state, with no recourse. Obviously, right? That's what the Branch Davidians did. They hung a banner out the window. Said, Rodney King, we understand. Black Lives Matter. Oh, by the way, about a third or a half of the Branch Davidians were black. They didn't really put that on TV very much because they were trying to just stick with the redneck in a Trans Am kind of thing so that you'd hate them. But anyway. He said he was Jesus. So I say go in there and hang him upside down until he's dead. That was the public opinion at the time. Not just the cops, that's what the people thought too. Anyway, so this is a different Waco massacre. This is a Waco massacre of bikers. And, oh, look, redneck with a mullet. They don't have Trans Ams, but what's a hog other than a skinny Trans Am, right? So, who cares about them? I say it's all of us non-government employees against the government employees. Forget all this tribalism. Forget race. I mean, seriously. Don't you know people of other races? Aren't they just the same as you, only their skin is a little bit different, but otherwise, what? You know, I heard a little British kid today talked about going with his dad to a refugee camp of Syrians in Turkey, I think it was. And he's playing with these little kids who were telling their horrible war stories and stuff. And they asked him, so what did you learn about the little kids? He goes, I mean, really? I mean, he's just a little kid. He's like 7 years old, right? What does he know how to say? He goes, well, I mean, basically, they're just like me. I was lucky to be born in a place without a war. They're just like me. Yeah, of course they're just like him. What the hell is this? The 21st century or not? The discrepancy between who's who around here is who has political power. You know, the right to murder you if they feel like it. And who does not. Which of us are those that they have the right to murder? That's the question. And yes, absolutely, race plays into it. Of course, you know, if you're a cop, law of averages, it's a lot easier to get away with killing a black guy than a white guy. So if killing somebody is a lot of fun and that's why you became a deputy sheriff, then obviously it makes sense to kill black people just because, you know, it's possible, however unlikely, that if you kill a white guy, well, he might be the nephew of a state senator or, you know, the cousin of a judge or something like that. And then you might stand a 1% chance of getting in a little bit of trouble, like have to do desk duty for a while or stand back and watch as the local taxpayers have to pay your fine for you. And so, you know, cops don't want that kind of accountability. So absolutely, race plays into it. Racial minorities, far easier to pick on and get away with picking on. But what it really comes down to, though, is blue supremacy, not white supremacy. You think it matters if the cops shooting the rifles and slaughtering the bikers at that restaurant in Waco, if any of those state troopers or local sheriffs were black guys or not? Man, just wait. You got to read this article. Once I interview this guy, and then you hear about this article, and then you go and read the article, you're going to be like, man, oh man, you believe this? Well, you'll hear all the reasons why in the interview. I think I remember all the most shocking stuff out of there. But anyway, I mean, you knew they were lying, right? They just arrest 100 guys. There's 9 dead, and they arrest 100 people. These are all guys in their 50s and 60s, but we're supposed to believe that they're, you know, the meanest biker gang of the, you know, the meanest faction of the Hell's Angels out of the movies from decades ago. When, no, they're not. They're lawyers and stuff, man. I mean, most of them are blue collar guys, but there's some white collar guys in there too. And they're not criminals. Not mostly. And anyway, it just goes to show, man, there's no law that rules the behavior of the law. They can do whatever they want. No accountability whatsoever. And it also goes to show about the compliance of the media and the compliance of American humans when it comes to partisanship and who's who. As, you know, Will Grigg, every time I talk with Will Grigg about police abuse on this show, he always quotes Vladimir Lenin saying that, you know, the only question is who does what to whom. That's it. Who's doing the doing? That's the only question. Not what is actually moral or actually legal or actually consistent with human rights at all. Just who's the one giving and who's the one getting it. And that's pretty much the ideology of the average American now, I guess. But for me, I don't think cops should be able to murder anybody. How do you like that? In fact, I think that the only prisons that should be open should be full of cops locked in there away from the rest of us so that we can be safe. And everybody else ought to be set free. How do you like that? And yes, I know that there are real criminals in the world, but the free market can take care of that. Don't you worry. Anyway, I just think it's hilarious to see how much people love government, no matter what they do. No matter what they do. Somebody just tweeted out a thing this morning that I thought was funny that had a cartoon Volkswagen van from the movie Cars, I guess. But, you know, it's one of them internet memes. It says, so Volkswagen lies about its diesel emissions and you boycott, but your government lies about everything and you want more. Yep. Nobody knows why, right? You ask a conservative, they'll be like, I hate the government. It's terrible because I want it to do the following 99 things to people and it won't hurry up and do it. And the liberals, they'll point at things that the government does that are horrible and that they hate. But it never dissuades them from the imagination of just what kind of society they could engineer if the power was theirs, you know? Except for the Vermont secessionists. They seem pretty good. But the rest of them, I don't know. Show me decentralists, communists. You know? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
I love Bitcoin, but there's just something incredibly satisfying about having real, fine silver in your pocket. That's why commodity discs are so neat. They're 1 ounce rounds of fine silver with a QR code on the back. Just grab your smartphone's QR reader, scan the coin, and you'll instantly get the silver spot price in Federal Reserve notes and Bitcoin. And if you donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, he'll send you one. Learn more at facebook.com/commoditydiscs. Commoditydiscs.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, so look here, man. I've been trying to track this lady down, and it worked. Her name is Martha Mundy, and she's an anthropologist, journalist, counterpuncher. Here at counterpunch.org, she wrote this thing, Yemen as Laboratory. Why is the West so silent about this savage war? And that's all I'm going to tell you about because she's going to be on the show tomorrow. How do you like that? I like it. Well, there's serious stuff. We'll get to Syria maybe later in the show. I want to talk to you about Iran and their nuclear program for a minute here. The Republicans have failed to defeat the Iran deal at this point, but it's not yet implementation day. And out of the corner of my eye, Netanyahu is at the United Nations ranting and railing, reminding me that it's not over yet here. The propaganda war continues. So here's a little bit of truth. You can find it at SIPRI.org. And here, I already tweeted it out this morning. You can find it on my Twitter feed, and I'm going to post the link here in the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat as well if you want to find it. Although, if you log in after now, you won't see it, right? But anyway, for those of you who are already in the chat room, for the rest of you, sign up, ask again. I'll put it in there if you want. scotthorton.org/chat, or just check out my Twitter feed. It's there. The Missing Large Explosion Chamber at Parchin by Robert Kelly. It's at SIPRI, SIPRI.org. SIPRI.org. The Missing Large Explosion Chamber at Parchin. It's a PDF file here. And Yosef Butt, our friend the nuclear physicist, sent this out this morning to his email list. Thanks for that, Yosef. And Yosef, I always say it wrong. I bet maybe that's why Nancy Yosef won't talk to me anymore, because I kept calling her Nancy Yosef, because I'm stupid. Anyway, Yosef Butt. He sent this out this morning, and it's Robert Kelly. He is Associate Senior Research Fellow at SIPRI. He is also a former Chief Nuclear Inspector for the IAEA. So, he's the kind of guy who's got expertise on these things. And what he does here is he explains why it is that there was no explosives testing chamber in the accusation room at the Parchin military base in Iran. The reason it wasn't there is because it never existed. And of course, there are already a bunch of, kooks and warmongers and liars who all happen to put Israel first for some reason, coincidentally, I'm sure it has nothing to do with their point of view on any of the rest of this, trying to say, oh, well, yeah, but that's just because they dragged it out so long, never mind their 24 days talking point or anything like that. Yeah, they dragged out the inspection so long that the Iranians secretly tore down the explosives testing chamber and got rid of it before the IAEA showed up last month. And Robert Kelly is explaining that, no, that's not true, and here's how we know it's not true. And he goes over all the reasons why to doubt that there ever was such an explosives testing chamber at the Parchin military base in that particular building or any other building. And that is because the timeline of when it was contracted, designed, and built makes no sense whatsoever. It's impossible. It's also not how you test an implosion system for a nuclear weapon. Doesn't make any sense. You do that kind of thing outside, not in a massive implosion testing chamber. Also, the guy who supposedly was the former Soviet nuclear weapon scientist who helped them do it, his expertise was nanodiamonds. And he never built a testing chamber for the Iranians. Anyway, I guess he had done some consulting with them or something, but had nothing to do with nuclear physics, of which he does not have a degree. And he's not a metallurgist either for, you know, forming a core or any kind of this stuff. His deal is making nanodiamonds for industry. And then he goes into more detail than I have seen about just what this chamber, what exactly the specifics of what this chamber supposedly was, all the concrete and steel involved, and how difficult it would have been to build it in the first place and then take it down without everybody knowing. We're talking about a massive, he even shows a picture, a sample picture of a kind of, you know, very thorough steel cage of rebar, you know, where, you know, each little square in between the rebar, the way they're all linked together is only, you know, a square half a foot or less than that, square 4 inches or something like that. And then, like, you know, a very thorough cage of rebar and then thoroughly filled with concrete. That means in order to take that apart, you would either have to use high explosives, which there's no evidence that they did that, or you'd need a huge work crew of guys from the Home Depot parking lot with blowtorches and jackhammers in there to take this thing apart piece by piece, to tear it down piece by piece, and a huge project of which there's just no evidence any of this ever took place there. A matrix, that's the word I was looking for. A matrix of rebar, because it would have to be that well and reinforced. And he's also explained in other places where in the cartoon drawing of this thing, obvious shades of Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations and his cartoon drawings of Saddam's non-existent mobile biological weapons labs. He explained previously, I think it's in the Parchin Puzzle at Loblog, where there was a picture of a nanodiamond creation chamber from Russia where it was sitting on some railroad ties, you know, some real thick wooden railroad ties, and that the artist who plagiarized that picture obviously didn't know what he was looking at and interpreted those railroad ties at the bottom to be some kind of reinforcement fins on the outside of the test chamber. And so for symmetry, he went ahead and put fins up at the top too. But so then to translate his computer drawing to real world means, oh yeah, and then it has these railroad ties sitting on top of it too. Genius. Great job. Yeah, Adelaide Stevenson with the satellite photos of the nukes going into Cuba. You're not. Liars. And so anyway, this has got to be the fifth time or something that Robert Kelly has debunked these accusations. They are now permanently debunked. And the whole accusation about, oh, 24 days, shot to hell. They already did the inspection. They didn't delay at all, and they're proven innocent, so shut up. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place. And features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Greg Grandin. He is the author of Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism, which has been sitting on my pile forever, and I curse myself for not having read yet, because, wow, what an interesting topic for a book. But then check out this new one, Kissinger's Shadow, brand new out. Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. And so how do you like that? He's got a piece at TomDispatch.com, which, of course, ran under Tom Englehart's name at Antiwar.com as well. Henry of Arabia. Welcome back to the show, Greg. It's been way too many years since we've spoken. How are you?
I know. Good, good. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great. I really appreciate you joining us today. And wow, what a great article. Of course, people would have to read volumes and volumes to catch up on all of the crimes of Henry Kissinger. So we're just, let's focus on this Tom Dispatch article here, and the way you narrow down the focus to the Persian Gulf and Henry Kissinger's legacy as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor and advisor to presidents ever since the 1960s and all the way through here, and just what a mess Kissinger himself has gotten us into. It's a really fun read, actually, the way you trace it all back. So the floor is yours, sir. Where would you like to begin?
Well, I would like to begin with the infrastructure of crisis and catastrophe that he put into place. I mean, some of Kissinger's well-known policies in the Middle East are well-known, his betrayal of the Kurds in 1975, serving them up to Saddam Hussein in Iraq once they outlived their usefulness in playing off Iran versus Iraq, and his shuttle diplomacy in winding down the 1973 Arab-Israeli war is fairly well known. But more broadly, the way that he did a number of things. One is that he built up Iran and Saudi Arabia at the same time, establishing the framework of massive arms transfers and sales. He gave the Shah pretty much what no other nation in the world had at that time, and that was the ability to buy whatever he wanted from the U.S. military. And, of course, using rising petrodollars, rising the profits from rising oil prices to pay for all of this. And that put and the support for the secret police, SEVAK, and put, in many ways, Iran on the road to radicalization and revolution. And then the same thing with Saudi Arabia. He worked out the same set of arrangements with Saudi Arabia. So in some ways, this Sunni-Shia conflict, which is engulfing the Gulf and which Kissinger himself warns about as the reason why the U.S. should reject the Obama's Iran deal, was put into place by Kissinger. And that's just the least of it. He also built up Pakistan's ISI and encouraged them to go. You know, when people talk about blowback and talk about CIA support for the jihadis and political Islam, they tend to focus on the 1980s, rightly so, and the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan and the CIA's move to destabilize that occupation. But Kissinger in many ways put that structure into place by reestablishing diplomatic relations with Pakistan after the genocide in Bangladesh in 1971, and then supporting ISI, and then encouraging Afghanistan to move into Afghanistan, to put Afghanistan into play. This is well before, the constant crisis and conflict and turmoil and radicalization that we now associate with the region. So I think Kissinger has a lot to answer for.
Yeah, well, and even then, on the Bangladesh thing, he was kind of in on that with them in the first place, too, right?
Yeah, he wanted to keep Pakistan as a correspondent between China and Washington, it had to do with him and Nixon wanting to normalize relations with China, and Pakistan played a role in facilitating that as an intermediary, as Pakistan was an ally of China, and Pakistan, Bangladesh, which at the time was East Pakistan, separated by India, there was a sense it was going to go left. that, you know, there were these secular modernists that were socialist and social democratic and Marxist. And, you know, Kissinger, and I mean, there's the transcripts. You know, Gary Bass wrote about this in the Blood Telegram in gruesome detail, but Kissinger and Nixon expedited that genocide.
All right, so there's so much there. Let's go back to the beginning. You say that, you know, Kissinger ramped up the arms sales to the Shah to such a degree, but the Shah had been put back in power, of course, by the Eisenhower administration and had been kept there by Kennedy and Johnson. So to what degree did they really increase it? What was the real shift between the Johnson and the Nixon years when it came to America's alliance with the Shah?
Oh, there was a qualitative difference under Kissinger in 72 with the Shah. You know, I start off the piece with, you know, that the only person that Kissinger flattered more was, you know, more than Nixon was the Shah of Iran. But it was in 72 that, you know, and the Shah had pretensions to be a regional leader. He wanted Iran to be treated as equals with other Cold War allies, including West Germany and Great Britain. And Kissinger accommodated, or at least pumped up those airs and those pretensions, and backed it up with arms sales. I mean, the numbers are staggering. I don't have the piece in front of me. Let me see if I can find it. But, you know, the numbers are just hard to grasp. By 1975, 1976, Iran and Saudi Arabia were the recipients of some of the largest amounts of U.S. You know, military, you know, arms sales. Let me see if I can find the numbers, which are, you know, the Shah, Kissinger, as James Schlesinger, who was Secretary of Defense, said Kissinger wanted to turn the Shah into the guardian of the Gulf. And he did. You know, by 1977, you know, the Shah had the largest navy in the Persian Gulf, had the largest air force in the West, in Western Asia, had the fifth largest army in the whole world, and thousands of tanks, hundreds of helicopters, hundreds of long-range artillery pieces and missiles, and, you know, F-4 fighters and F-5 fighters. In 1978, the Shah brought $12 billion worth of equipment. So there's a political economy here, too. What you know, the rise of energy costs and the creation of petrodollars, mm-hmm. and then the use of those petrodollars to recycle them back into the military-industrial complex. And this is the beginning of the post-Vietnam wind-down. So they had to, you know, where the military budget was being lowered in the United States. So in some ways, the petrodollars from Iran and Saudi Arabia floated the military. There's a great book, The Oil Kings, by Cooper. I can't remember his first name. But he interviewed Schlesinger, and Schlesinger admitted that basically Iran funded research and development, you know, in military equipment through the 1970s, just by how much money they were pouring into the defense industry.
And then, so, what's a SAVAK?
Oh, SAVAK is S-A-V-A-K, is the infamous Iranian secret police, the death squads, you know, the intelligence structure of Iran that supported the Shah and was bloody and repressive, and the horror stories of the torture that SAVAK presided over, and particularly as protests against the Shah built up steam. And somebody like George Ball, who was a career diplomat, called Kissinger's support for the Shah an act of folly, you know, that basically it just shut down any possible internal evolution and led to the religious radicalization.
All right, well, so that's a very important point right there, the blowback, the revolution, the blowback, not just from the Shah being the Shah, but the escalation of American support for him and his death squads and all that, leading to the revolution. Interesting stuff. Hang tight, everybody. We'll be right back with Greg Grandin, author of Kissinger's Shadow, right after this. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. Now, I know it's fun to trace America's horrible interventions back to Woodrow Wilson or McKinley or Lincoln even, Washington, wherever you want. Each intervention causes the crisis that becomes the excuse for the next intervention. And so Greg Grandin, author of the brand new book, Kissinger's Shadow, is filling in some details on the excuses for our current interventions and their roots in Henry Kissinger's policies in the 1970s, ramping up support for the Shah militarily and for his internal secret police forces, whose clampdown, resultant clampdown, helped lead to the revolution of 1979. And then, as you point out in here, and I had always read it was Brzezinski at the behest of David Rockefeller, but apparently it was Kissinger at the behest of Nelson Rockefeller, I guess. you know, they worked for different Rockefellers who had Jimmy Carter, who pressured Jimmy Carter. You have to let the Shah into America. And maybe you can fill us in on this. Someone was just asking me about this the other day on the Twitter there about CIA and State Department support for the Ayatollah revolution in 79, because they knew the Ayatollah, because he'd helped overthrow Mossadegh and install the Shah back in 53. And they told the French, go ahead and let him go home from Paris. And because they figured everything would be all right, just like the Israelis kept their relationship with the Iranians after the revolution, they thought it would be okay. But then Kissinger and or Brzezinski, at the behest of the Rockefellers, pressured Carter to let the Shah into the United States for asylum. You say in your article, I always thought it was just for medical treatment, but either way. And then that was what led to the riot and the seizing of the embassy hostages and the real crisis of the revolution.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm not, I don't have specific information about the CIA. It would make sense that if once the revolution was getting underway, that they might want to support the Ayatollahs as a way to moderate what they thought would be two leftist or, you know, secular nationalist factions. And they thought maybe they could play one off the other. And obviously they weren't able to do that. Yes, Kissinger advocated and lobbied for the Shah to be let in, and that led to further radicalization. I mean, this is not unlike what happened in Venezuela in 1959 during after the dictatorship fell and the U.S. took in the dictator who was a torturer and repressor, and that led to, you know, one of the reasons why the crowds besieged Nixon as vice president during his campaign there. So you see those patterns over and over again, and as you put it so nicely at the beginning of this segment, right, every intervention creates the conditions and justifications for the next interventions. And that's one of the things I was trying to get in at this book about Kissinger. Not that I think that I don't think that you could expunge Kissinger from U.S. history and you would have a virtuous republic. I think that U.S. interventionism is structural and goes beyond the evilness of any one man. But Kissinger does bear quite a bit of responsibility, but he's also illuminating. You know, during his last book tour last year, when he was asked about Cambodia and Chile, overthrowing Chile in 73 and bombing Cambodia in 69 to 73, you know, he was largely left off the hook by reporters, but one or two did ask him a few critical questions. You know what he said? He pointed to Obama and he said, well, it's how is it different than Obama's drone program, Cambodia? How is Chile different from what we did in Libya? And, you know, perversely, he's not wrong. And, you know, and those justifications in 69, 70, 71, 72, 73 were so far out of the mainstream, Kissinger couldn't make them in public. But now the idea that we have the right to attack a sovereign country to root out the safe havens or sanctuaries of enemies is the underwrites the authorization for the use of military force. It underwrites the drone program. It underwrites the global counterinsurgency. But what's also interesting about that Kissinger's crazy defense is it illustrates exactly the 40-year history. Kissinger is invoking today's endless wars and regime change to justify what he did 40 years ago, but what he did 40 years ago in some ways created the context and momentum for today's endless wars. So this that perfect circle of U.S. militarism is right there in Kissinger's justification and militarism.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You read in the Glaspie memo, and Saddam Hussein is explaining on the eve of his invasion of Kuwait that, well, hey, man, I thought we had a deal. And I borrowed all this money from the Kuwaitis and the Saudis to fight this war basically for them, to contain the Iranian Revolution this whole time. And now they've got the price of oil so low, including overproducing from shared wells on the border. They got the price so low, I can't possibly pay them back the money that I owe them, which is ruining the whole economy here in Iraq as well. We can't reinvest nothing. We gave up everything. And so he's just complaining about the consequences from the last war when, oops, we have a revolution in Iran. Now we got to do something against it. And then that reminds me of the WikiLeaks. Thank you, Chelsea Manning, where the Saudi king is reported to have said, I don't understand it. It was always you, me, and Saddam against Iran. But now you've given Iraq to Iran on a golden platter, not even just a silver one. And so, but anyway, it's just back and forth with all these very same things and the consequences of one. Saddam Hussein then invades Kuwait and they go, oh, no, you can't do that. That becomes the excuse for the Americans to occupy the Arabian Peninsula, wage the first Gulf War and then the blockade and the no-fly zones, which, of course, led to the conditions of the terrorist war against us and the excuse making after 9/11 and on and on.
And Kissinger supported all of that. Kissinger, you know, going back and looking at what Kissinger said during the first Gulf War was interesting. You know, Gene Kirkpatrick, so there's a bunch of Cold War conservatives that came out against, you know, the quote-unquote liberation of Kuwait. Kirkpatrick said, what does it matter who pumps the gas? And Kissinger was the first out of the box to attack what he called the new isolationists. You know, Saddam, and he was one of the first people to equate Saddam Hussein with Hitler back in 1990. And Kirkpatrick backpedaled. And you know, within a few weeks, she was supporting the buildup and invasion. Mm-hmm. So Kissinger has always, you know, and he supported the 2000, or he was an early supporter, not just of going into Iraq, but if you read his op-ed in August 2002, he wanted to go into Yemen and Somalia as well. So in terms of the militarization of the Middle East, he's been a constant, you know, force accelerator.
Hey, by the way, I know, I think he's not a signatory to all the Project for a New American Century documents calling for regime change against Iraq in the 1990s. I assume he was obviously on board with the status quo of the permanent blockade and sanctions and all that.
No,
was there ever any real quarrel there between him and the neocons? Or there were
real quarrels. I think they had real political differences over Israel, but I think that focusing on Israel misses the way Kissinger, one of the arguments of the book is that misrecognizing Kissinger as a realist opposed to the neocons misrecognizes a fundamental aspect of U.S. militarism. Kissinger was a high subjectivist, an idealist. You can go back and read his stuff. He believes that reality doesn't exist, that the only meaning we could draw from reality is the meaning that we give it through our actions. So there's a lot of similarity between the neocons' will to power and Kissinger. There were political differences. There were political differences about the Soviet Union and Israel, which manifest themselves in rivalries. Kissinger wasn't part of the New American Century, but throughout the 1990s, he was constantly riding the Clinton administration to bomb and bomb some more in Iraq. He would say it's not about weapons of mass destruction. It's about being able to break the back of somebody we've said we will not negotiate with, and we have to be able to match our military power with our objectives, or we will look like we are weak and impotent. And so when 9/11 came, you know, he was ready to go, and there was a convergence of him and the neocons.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because it was actually just in the news, I think 1 week before the September 11th attacks, that this guy's under investigation for war crimes. And it was even, you know, it's kind of scandalous. His reputation was getting bad enough even in mainstream media where these kind of things could be talked about. And if I remember right, it was a criminal investigation in Chile or something. I don't know exactly what. Somewhere in Latin America or something. And then right. 1 week later, oh, Henry Kissinger, you're an expert on terrorism. Yeah, he sure as hell is. Go ahead and tell us what to do, Henry.
Yeah, that's the thing about Kissinger. So even if we want to grant Kissinger the achievement that his defenders want to, détente, Kissinger takes actions in the Middle East and Southern Africa that undermine the possibility of détente maturing. You know, he basically helps create a world in the third world that makes the neocon vision of permanent militarism seem like a reasonable response. So even if we want to say that, oh, he believed in interdependence and he was willing to negotiate and, you know, but he creates the conditions where that kind of diplomacy is no longer possible. And by the time you get, the arms build up and the push into, you know, so that's Kissinger.
Great. Hello? Greg, still there?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm an idiot. I gave you a whole outro and everything with my mic off because I left it off because I was being polite so I wouldn't interrupt you. And then I said, oh, yeah, this and that. That's the great Greg Grandin, everybody, blah, blah, blah. And then I looked and the light was off and everything.
I started hearing the Sanford Sutton theme song.
I know. And then you're sitting there going, where did he go? What happened? Why didn't he say goodbye or anything?
I'm still going on about Kissinger.
Yeah, no, you did great. You pretty much wrapped up when you needed to and everything was fine except that I wasn't there. So now I'm going to fake it. So just be polite. All right, everybody, that is the great Greg Grandin. The book is Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. Brand new out. Find it at Amazon or your local bookshop, etc. And read him at tomdispatch.com, Henry of Arabia. Really great article there. And, of course, it's also under Tom Engelhart's name at antiwar.com. Thanks again, Greg. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Scott. Always great to be on.
Respondent Richard Roth. You heard the professor there saying that Benjamin Netanyahu was a bit preachy, apocalyptic, but he certainly gave it to the UN, saying that the UN was obsessively hostile to Israel, obsessively bashed Israel.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up on the show is Nathaniel Penn, writing for GQ. And you can find this story at GQ.com, The Untold Story of the Texas Biker Gang Shootout. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Nathaniel?
I'm very well. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you on the show here. Great piece of journalism you put together. And, you know, I was suspicious that the story was something along these lines, although I admit that I've not been keeping up with it very much. Seems like this is a huge story. Maybe one of the biggest stories is how little competition you had in writing this. Would that be fair to say, you think?
I think I was the beneficiary of a little bit of luck. I finished reporting the story at the end of July, just before a gag order was imposed in the case. So I sort of had it to myself after that point.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that's good. I'm glad you got the work done. We're talking about the second Waco massacre, basically, at the Twin Peaks restaurant here. The biker gang shootout, they called it. But you kind of dispute that characterization and really just say mostly these are biker clubs. Well, who are they? What were they doing there? What's the big deal?
So this was a meeting of an organization called the Confederation of Clubs and Independents, which is a sort of umbrella organization for Texas biker clubs. It's a motorcycle rights organization. They lobby on the state and federal level for things like anti-profiling legislation, a whole bunch of motorcycle safety legislation. They're quite a successful organization. And they have these meetings bi-monthly across the state. There are 9 regions, each with its own COC meeting. And this was kind of a special meeting. And that's in large measure what led to the incidents that we're going to be talking about today. This was a special meeting, number one, because there'd never been one in Waco before, which means there was no meaningful level of interaction, no meaningful relationship between the bikers and the police in Waco. The second thing is that this meeting was convened with more people than usual because a sort of key national figure in the biking world was coming back from a big powwow with other similar people at his level and wanted to address as many Texas bikers as possible about these legislative initiatives that they're working on. So it was a sort of perfect storm in a sense. You know, the Waco Police Department did not have experience dealing with bikers. They had seemingly a lot of preconceptions about bikers. And rather than wait and see what might happen, they decided that the existence of this meeting, the fact of it's happening with high value intelligence, even though it was all over the website of this organization that this meeting was taking place, the police treated the news of this meeting as a really a piece of high value intelligence. And in their anxiety, and I would say also opportunism, they were waiting that day. They got there before the bikers did. They got there in force. Many cruisers, a SWAT van, high caliber rifles. They were ready for something to happen. And if you believe some of the more paranoid, and I don't mean that in a dismissive way, if you believe some of the more paranoid accounts that that I heard when I was interviewing people for this story, the police may have planted undercover agitators, essentially, in one of the two biker clubs that sort of began to fight that day, the Cossacks, but may have planted undercover agitators in that group who were there to instigate some sort of fracas. I don't think that the idea was or could have been for it to turn into a turkey shoot. I don't think the cops came there thinking, okay, we're going to kill 9 people today. I think they came there thinking there's going to be a fight. There are going to be knives. People are going to be, brawling, and we're going to get 30 or 40 people in jail. And if we're lucky, we're going to get them to, rat out their fellow club members on a whole bunch of stuff. That's what they were thinking, I think.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think you're probably right about that, and that there must be a way to prove that, not that FOIA is, you know, can pry loose everything, but with, you know, you get Dick DeGaron on this thing or something, one of these, there's some badass Texas lawyers. I would hire Dick DeGaron, man. He was Koresh's lawyer, the other Waco massacre. Anyway, you get those guys on there, they'll get to the bottom of this, you know, I mean, and in fact, the way you describe the process of how this is taking place there with the grand jury and the rest of it, it seems like some adequate defense lawyers could hand these cops back their ass pretty quickly here with just what you've revealed in your article, never mind what they could get with legal discovery and so forth.
You know, I'd hope so, but the way this case has proceeded is so bizarre. Every time the law, every time law enforcement has screwed up, they have doubled down on that screw up. You know, and some people suggested to me that there's a kind of Texas mentality prevailing here that, you know, you commit to something and you don't back down. But the law enforcement has committed to some stuff that's going to be very difficult to prove in court. That said, you know, and I would like to be optimistic as you are and think that somebody, and there actually is a Dallas lawyer who's working for one of the, a very high powered Dallas lawyer who's working for one of the men who was arrested in this case. You probably have heard about this. I would like to think that they can uncover something, but the way that the Waco justice system works, and that I think is what this story is finally about. It's not about biker culture, which is what I thought it was about when I started working on it, that it was about how even in this day and age, you know, 50 years past what maybe a lot of us think is the heyday, the golden age of motorcycle clubs or motorcycle gangs, this stuff still matters so much to members of these clubs that they would shoot each other. They would brawl over things that seem so ridiculous to us, territorial stuff, etc. I mean, obviously that's not what this case is about. So it turns out not to be about motorcycle culture. It turns out to be about the Waco justice system, about the DA's former law partner being the judge in this case, about until he was pushed on it, the person who was going to lead the group, the committee that was going to choose the grand jury, being the DA's father, and the leader, the foreman of one of the two grand juries, being a Waco police detective who is still active, who was sworn in with, who took his place in the courtroom on his first day with his badge and his gun, and who appears to have been involved in the case.
Yeah, he said, they asked him, what was your involvement in the case? He said, or were you involved in the case? Not really, he said.
Yeah, yeah.
What does that mean? He was just passing out the rifles that morning?
The Dallas lawyer I mentioned to you registered a formal complaint with the court about this, and he said it's like that old episode of I Love Lucy where she gets stopped for speeding in the small southern town, and then when she arrives in the courtroom, the judge is the cop who stopped her for speeding. It's exactly like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing, too. I mean, in fact, I would think that some people in the audience went, wait, what? Did you just say that the judge is the DA's former partner and the guy in charge of picking the grand jury was the DA's father, and that the first foreman on the grand jury was an active duty detective from the department who he's investigating and who he's admitted that he was at least somewhat involved in the actual crime that he's investigating here? Couldn't be.
Yeah. It's almost a show trial.
I mean, that's absolutely ridiculous. I'm sorry, I should have left my microphone off so I wouldn't be laughing all through your explanation of that, except that I got burned leaving my mic off on the last guest, so I didn't want to do that again. Yeah, absolutely amazing here. Now, so I'm sorry, we're almost at the break, but I want to go ahead and cut to this chase real quick before we have to stop for a couple of minutes. And that is the quote, which I don't have in front of me, so I'll roughly paraphrase it, but it's something to the effect of, hey, I'm a combat veteran, and I know what handguns sound like, and I know what rifles sound like. And what happened was there were a few pop, pop, pops of a handgun that maybe came from bikers, but then everything after that was the cops on the perimeter with their AR-15s, I'm assuming, but whatever, rifles, just blowing these guys away.
Yeah, you know, the Bandidos and the Cossacks are bitter enemies and they agree on very little, but their stories about this aspect of what happened that day were extremely consistent. And they acknowledge, by the way, that those first few pops did come from bikers. They're not denying that. But what they are saying is that the number of shots that were fired by the number of shots that were fired from suppression weapons, if that's the correct terminology, was far, far in excess of what the police are claiming. The police say they shot 12 rounds. The bikers say they think it was close to 100. In a lawsuit that the nearby Don Carlos restaurant fired about this, they claim it was thousands of rounds that were fired.
All right, stop right there. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Nathaniel Penn, writer for GQ magazine, about this great piece of journalism that he's put together here, The Untold Story of the Texas Biker Gang Shootout. This thing is huge, man. This ought to be all over the place all the time. And, you know, I really made a mistake there, two mistakes. Obviously, one, bringing up who shot who right before the break. But secondly, what I really should have done was brought up the mass arrest since we had just been talking about the farcical nature of who's who in charge of the process here in Waco, the next step would have been how they arrested how many people and put what level of bond on them, and where the hell are other judges at higher levels in the state or the federal something to make them stop doing what they're doing, or what is going on with that? Please explain.
Yeah, they arrested 177 men and women that day. Originally, they told these people they were going to be witnesses, but as time went on, the tone of the cops who were speaking with them suddenly changed, and they went on this sort of odyssey through the legal system. They were brought to a local convention center with their hands plastic cuffed behind their backs. They were fed with their hands plastic cuffed behind their backs. They were left that way for 18 hours. They slept with their hands plastic cuffed behind their backs. Their phones were taken from them and have not yet been returned, allegedly because the cops were trying to figure out what the network of contacts of these guys were in order to potentially build a RICO case against them or support a RICO case against them. I suspect the phones were also taken because there is bound to be some citizen video of the shootings on those phones. And as you know, there's been precious little video to emerge from this incident. The cops have suppressed it ever since the incident occurred, which in and of itself does not make them look very good. So these people who were arrested, these 177 people, were placed under a $1 million bond each, as you mentioned, $1 million bond each, on the grounds that the justice of the peace, who had no legal training but had formerly been an administrator in the law enforcement system, the justice of the peace decided he wanted to send a message, which, as you know, is unconstitutional. You don't arrest, you don't establish bond based on sending a message. You establish bond based on the severity of the offense that was committed. The justice of the peace signed 177 what have been referred to cookie cutter pages of charges against these people. None of them were specifically tailored to the individual people. They all said exactly the same thing. That also is apparently illegal. The people who were imprisoned were there for, I believe the least number of days was 27. And last I heard, there are still two people imprisoned, one who can't make bail, and one whom I think the cops think they can actually establish a link to the shootings for. There were examining trials a few weeks ago, the first few examining trials, and the idea behind these trials, as you may know, is to find out what the nature of the charges are against these people and to get them dismissed. So all the defense lawyers lined up their little old ladies. The bikers who clearly had nothing to do with this had spotless records. You know, there was a chaplain among them. There was a husband and wife from a mom and pop club. You know, people who are blameless. And even those people were not able to get their charges dismissed. And promptly, all the other defense lawyers pulled back their clients from these examining trials because they realized it was going to look worse for them down the line if it was established that there was, quote unquote, enough evidence to charge them. So now what we're waiting for is the indictments. And the lawyers told me that the city seems to be pushing this back as far as it possibly can, probably for two reasons. Number one, I think that they're hoping that under pressure, because these guys face up to 177 people face up to 99 years on the grounds of engaging in criminal activity where murder took place. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought there for a second.
I'll give you a chance, or I'll go ahead if you want.
No, I'm gonna get. I think. Remind me what I was just saying.
Oh well, yeah. Good luck with that. kind of stone too, man. But no.
So okay, I got it. So the idea is they want these people either to rat out other gang members. That's one thing that they're hoping will happen as time passes and these people are under the sword of possibly serving 99 years. That's their number one hope. Their number two hope is that they'll plead out to lesser charges, which will thus prevent them later on from filing suit for wrongful imprisonment, because that's sort of what's lingering in the background here. The city is already
threatening them with life, and then they'll just sign whatever you say.
Well,
then
they can't sue you. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Absolutely amazing. So now here was, I didn't form my question very well in the beginning, but so now my follow-up question to that is, and I ain't no lawyer, and I don't know if you talked to any about this or what, but there are higher level courts in the state of Texas where it seems like some of these motions could be appealed before this thing goes any further. Like, hey, obviously the justice of the peace didn't know the law and broke it when he did what he did. So Texas State Supreme Court or somebody else undo it. No?
On that specific question, a complaint was just filed, I think, on the 25th, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, the lawyers have been trying to get the video made public, and the cops have managed to stymie them again and again. You know, the justice system in Waco does not want this case to be exposed to sunlight. Yeah. And they have been very, very successful in preventing that from happening.
All right. And now, so back to the shooting real quick. You got the banditos and the Cossacks, and a fist fight breaks out, and maybe someone did get shot with a handgun. You quote some people saying, well, they thought that maybe it was just somebody firing in the air, like, hey, everybody quit brawling kind of a thing. But then, well, so go ahead and elaborate. And if you want, you could go back to the possible provocateurs. You're saying the guys basically revealed their badges, that they, you know, who were the undercover guys, that maybe they had helped start the fist fight in the first place?
So eyewitnesses have claimed two things, one of which is a little more provable right now. One claim is that there were two members of the Cossacks inside the restaurant who, when the shooting began, stood up, revealed that they had badges, and took their guns and went out and engaged in the fight. Number two, that there was another undercover officer, perhaps one of these two, it's unclear, was literally moving back and forth between the crime scene and the police side. And there are actually photographs of this guy. So it does seem fairly, the allegation that there were undercover cops there seems documentable. Incidentally, in announcing that his cops had only fired 12 rounds, the police chief was careful to say he was talking about the cops in their cruisers, not about undercovers on the scene. As far as I know, there has been no public acknowledgement that there were undercovers on the scene. So the first few shots, it's interesting. I talked to a guy who was there when the first shot, who was, you know, 5 feet away from the guy who fired the first shot. And it was fired at another gang member, another club member. The guy who saw the shot fired actually wants very badly, has been cooperating with the cops. He wants very badly to try to maintain the good name of these clubs to the extent that he's able. He said that he has spent many hours looking at mugshots with the police, and that he cannot find the face of the person who did this. There does seem to be, as I mentioned, agreement among the various participants, if there's agreement on anything, on the fact that the first few shots came from bikers, subsequent shots came from cops. As you know, what little evidence has emerged suggests that at least some of the men who were killed by police bullets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you quote guys again who are invoking their military experience, et cetera, and saying, hey, look, we're talking headshots and perfect chest shots. These
right.
are not bikers with handguns in the middle of a fist fight with guns going off. These
That's
are
exactly
shots
right.
from distance, well aimed.
That's exactly right. And their military experience is to such an extent that I heard stories about guys in prison, in jail afterwards. Suffering severe PTSD flashbacks from having been part of this war zone.
Amazing. And just the radio silence on this thing is just incredible. Or maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe conservative talk radio has been covering this somewhat. I don't know. It's certainly not on the TV or in much of the internet I read, and I read a hell of a lot.
You know, you mentioned that this is an important story, and I kind of wanted to connect the dots a little bit and explain why I think it's an important story.
Go ahead, sure.
To me, it's very much part of the story that we've been seeing over the last year of cops who are acting recklessly, overzealously, with excess force against young men, predominantly young black men, and in one case, a young black female teenager around the country. This is yet another instance of overzealous cops overreacting against a stigmatized population, because bikers don't have a lot of friends in as you know, except for other bikers. And I think that's why it's of urgent importance, because the cops are, it seems as though they've sort of moved to a new level here. They've decided they can get away with what they've been doing in the black community, and now they've moved on to this other stigmatized community where they think they can get away with it, and this kind of behavior has to be reined in.
Yeah, well, you're right on target there. It's the fact that they know that there's no accountability. The yep. leash is off. Like yep. just as Donald Rumsfeld told the Delta Force in 2001 in Afghanistan, grab whom you must, do what you want. There are no mm-hmm. rules. And that goes down to the local sheriff deputy at the side of the road. And they know the worst trouble they're going to get in 2 weeks paid vacation and a laugh. And so it continues on. And yeah, racism is all tied up in it. But racism, in a way, it seems almost obscures what's really going on here. Right. Yeah. It's blue supremacy that we're dealing with here more than white supremacy by far. In fact, as you say in here, some of these guys may have had some SS lightning bolts. The white supremacists are the victims of the blue supremacists in this one.
It's true.
Yep. All right. Listen, thank you so much for doing this great work and for coming on my show to talk about it. I sure appreciate it, Nathaniel.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, y'all. That is Nathaniel Penn. You got to read this whole thing. There's a lot we didn't get to. Just read it. It's GQ.com, The Untold Story of the Texas Biker Gang Shootout. Right back. Hey, y'all. Guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. Yeah, you guys got to read this thing. Sorry, recorded a little bit in the break there. I know that sounds bad when we go out to the break and we're still in the middle of talking, but didn't want to interrupt. Yeah, man, it's such an important story. Please go and read it. The Untold Story of the Texas Biker Gang Shootout. And like I say, and this is the case with a lot of things we discuss on the show, the blackout from the rest of the media on the subject is part of the story, maybe the biggest part of the story. And especially, you know, when you read this thing, it becomes real clear who was gunning down who here. And so how do you spin that, you know? So you just ignore it, lest you give a talking point to Vladimir Putin, like he brought up Ferguson the other day. But anyway, there you go, Soviet America. Read it and weep, pal. This is the government you love so much. These are the cops on the shows you tune in and watch. Well, I don't mean you, sorry. Them others that you and I agree are dumb. Anyway, all right, so we got to talk about the Middle East, man. So Netanyahu gave a speech at the, here, let me Google it again. I had a Google page here. Where'd it go? I was trying to find the text of it. Netanyahu text in the Google News here. I don't see a text to the speech here yet. Sorry. Well, he was talking, but I was interviewing somebody else about something else. So I was not able to read along here. It just happened to coincide with the show here today. But whatever, what he said was, I saw on Twitter that he said, oh yeah, no, I'm totally into having a two-state solution with the Palestinians. Groan. Give me a break. Whole world shifts as 7 billion people roll their eyes at once. Shut up, you lying liar. We were listening when you told the truth, when you said that, yeah, right, like I'm ever going to let there be a two-state solution. We were paying attention then. We don't believe you now. Someone's going to have to make them. Or else at least the Americans are going to have to quit protecting them. But anyway, I don't know. That's, again, it's the side issues that fascinate me. Hey, Netanyahu bothered to pretend and say that today at the UN. I wonder why he bothered to pretend and say that. Hey, maybe you don't know about this. Maybe it happened, but you weren't paying attention that week. Why don't you put into your Google video search Netanyahu absurd. It fits. That's how you'll remember. It's really easy search terms. Netanyahu absurd. And what it is footage from a secretly recorded conversation in Hebrew, although it's plenty translated for you there, and by Israeli media. So not, oh, Hezbollah translation or some crap, some spin. And what happens is at the beginning of the video, toward the beginning of the video, he goes, well, you guys are turning that off, right? And I guess somebody walks over to turn it off, or maybe they don't, but he just forgets and just assumes that it's off. And so he just speaks frankly, he knows there's a camera there, but he's speaking as though he believes it's not on anyway. I'm not exactly sure whether they pretended to turn it off or whether they tried to, but they just accidentally hit the button twice, not once, or what. But anyway, I just didn't push down hard enough on that whole thing. And so anyway, there's Netanyahu saying, yeah, so here's how I screwed Bill Clinton right in the face. Ha ha. I told him, hey, Bill, yeah, we'll give up the West Bank, except Area C. We got to have Area C. That's our security concerns, you see. So we're going to have a little bit of occupation just in Area C in order, you know, that we can have our military there for security. And then Bill agreed to that because, ha, what a stupid idiot. And so here's where I raped them some more. And then, it turns out Area C is like 2/3 of the West Bank. Ha, ha, ha. We get to keep the whole thing. And Bill Clinton can go rape himself for a change. And, ha, 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 ha. And then the settlers whose house he's visiting, they ask him, yeah, but might you not piss off the Americans who, after all, are our patrons and we're 100% dependent on them? And Netanyahu laughs and jokes at your expense and says, oh, America is easily moved. That's the direct quote. America is easily moved. 80% of its people support us. It's absurd, he said. Doesn't matter what we do. Doesn't matter if we slap the President of the United States right in the face, the high office of the President, because shut up, you'll believe what you're told. You'll fear who you're told. You'll bomb who you're told. And yeah, we'll give up the West Bank, except Area C. What a joke. And you know, that's what they say about, and by the way, I hated Bill Clinton before and better than all of y'all the whole time he was in power. So this isn't like me siding with him or anything. It's just an interesting anecdote, that's all. That the first time Bill Clinton met Benjamin Netanyahu, he was said to have remarked, who the F does this guy think he is? I can't believe it. Because he just walked in and said, all right, Bill, here's what you're going to do. You're going to get down on your knees, grab your little pencil and a piece of paper, and these are your marching orders, boy. And Bill Clinton thought, well, shit, I'm the emperor of the planet Earth, man. And you're the mayor of Baltimore compared to me. So, huh? But, you know, that's just how Benjamin Netanyahu does business. And then we see who won in the end, the emperor or the prime minister. Anyway, don't worry about the Americans. They're easily moved. It's absurd. No matter what we say or what we do, the Americans will continue to serve Israeli interests, said the once and future and present and now again Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. Anyway, good fun there. So let's see. I'm sure he complained about the Iran deal, but that's just kind of funny, right? In fact, out of the corner of my eye, the only thing I know about the Iran speech, really, I saw a couple of tweets, right? But what I saw of the Netanyahu speech at the UN looked like an empty hall. I saw a tweet that said that John Kerry and Samantha Power didn't even show up to watch it. Oh, it was Andrea Mitchell was tattletailing on them, but someone else retweeted it. So I think that's the silver lining on it, is that nobody shows Israel any respect because, hey, and I mean the government, the state of Israel, because they don't deserve any. No honor, even among thieves. And so Netanyahu gives his hectoring speech to a virtually empty hall. That's always fun. I don't know, maybe they had the MEK hire some bums to come in and fill a few seats. They actually get away with that pretty regularly, you know? You know what we'll do? We'll hire some bums. We'll give them brand new yellow t-shirts. Nah, don't bother shaving them or anything. It'll be fine. Everyone will buy it. Beards are in style. Birds too. Beards are in style right now. Everyone will think they're with us. Everybody supports the MEK. Come on. All right. So Syria or Yemen. I guess we got to talk about Yemen, man. Yemen is laboratory. Again, I'm going to have Martha Mundy on the show. But the people there are starving to death, man. And I don't really know who to tell you to read about all the best details of that. Music's already playing. One more segment. I'm going to do better than this on Yemen on the other side of this break. It's really the most important thing going on right now. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Well, first I got to read this, man. 3,842 killed in Iraq in September. God dang. This is like June 07 level worst of Iraq War II numbers here, man. Margaret Griffiths, the incomparable Margaret Griffiths at original.antiwar.com/updates. Never has stopped this whole time compiling the Iraqi dead every day. Antiwar.com found that at least 647 civilians and security personnel were killed across Iraq during September. Another 736 were wounded. Militants lost lost 3,195 personnel, while 397 of them were known wounded. Adding these brings the preliminary figures to 3,842 killed and 1,133 wounded in the last month. As more figures are released tomorrow, these will be revised. These figures do not include any casualties related to airstrikes on the Kurdistan Workers' Party by the Turks. Wow. Anyway, it goes on, man. Every day continues going on. All right, so now on Yemen, I think we're running it today, aren't we? Where is it? Or was it yesterday? No, it was yesterday. We ran a good one at antiwar.com about Yemen. Let me find it for you here. Yes, Shane Smith. The U.S. is neck deep in Yemeni blood. And that's the most important thing for you to understand, other than that thousands and thousands of people are being killed and virtually the entire population is at risk of starvation. I don't know what percentage of them are at what level of starvation now, but it is some. I was reading Middle East Eye. I had a thing. Where the hell did that go? I guess I don't have it now. There was a thing in Middle East Eye about the hunger kicking in, as was well predicted in advance. The blockade, the full blockade of trade against Yemen has gone on for more than 6 months now. I wondered to what degree the CIA, the State Department, the White House actually directly contact their associates in media and say, look, we just don't want you talking about Yemen, so just forget it. You know? There must be at least some of that. I mean, I know mostly it's just consensus that time to ignore it. But, you know, you might recall, boy, I remember where I was, Christmas Day 2009. Remember when you found out some guy tried to blow up a plane over Detroit, but luckily his underpants bomb only blew his nuts off and didn't hurt anybody else? I guess it just burned him. It didn't really explode. Anyway, and yes, it is true. And I'd spaced this out and forgotten it at one point, and then someone in the chat room screamed at me, and they were right, that Patrick Kennedy of the State Department admitted on the record in front of the Senate, or maybe the House, but at Congress, in testimony before Congress on C-SPAN, said, yes, we were tracking Abdul Muttalib and let him into the country deliberately because we wanted to see who he was going to contact. But, oops, had a bomb in his pants. Shouldn't have let him in, kind of thing. So they were tracking him. And remember Richard Wolff, remember him from MSNBC? He was writing a very, very authorized biography of Obama in his first year there. And he said on MSNBC that it was pretty clear that Obama was making it known through this guy on TV right now that the president himself is suspicious that maybe the intelligence officers let this guy through, because otherwise there's no way he should have been able to get through. And that maybe they were doing it to try to, you know, force some kind of policy on him, something like that. That was a big deal. Remember that? That Obama would make that known on MSNBC that way. And it was pretty clear, you know, that came from his chief of staff or, you know, among those guys. That's who Wolf was speaking for when he said it. But anyway, I'm off on a tangent, but just so you know, the point being that America had been bombing Yemen for 6 weeks straight. Jason Ditz had been covering it at news.antiwar.com. on a regular basis. Obama gave his West Point speech November 2009, and at the end of the speech, he said, and this was the surge, we're going to double down and still lose the war in Afghanistan speech, November 2009 at West Point. And at the end of the speech, he said, hey, and that ain't all. Yemen and Somalia, you're next. And what he meant was, you're still, but we're going back to war against you. We're doubling down against you both. And then, yeah, it was already on. He'd been bombing them for 2 weeks at that point. He bombed them for another couple of weeks, including the most famous attack that killed all the women and children. I believe it was 20-something women and children killed with cluster bombs, which means their bodies torn apart in the most unimaginable kind of circumstances. I mean, just go and look at cluster bombs on YouTube, dude, and imagine somebody killing your family that way. That's how Americans do business. And anyway, and this is the journalist, Obama made sure that the Yemeni government kept that journalist, what's his name, I can't remember it anymore, in prison for a couple of years for reporting on it. All that was going on in the lead up to the attempted attack by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who, were behind putting Abdul Muttalib on that plane and sending him to the United States. And imagine if that had happened, a plane full of at least a few dozen people, maybe 100 or more people, over a major American city. Straight out of Hollywood type of destruction. Mass casualties. Almost happened. Almost let it happen. But anyway, don't be confused when there's blowback. We got America right now bombing Al-Qaeda in Yemen with drones still this whole time, making them more and more powerful with every strike. at the same time that America also is coordinating the entire Saudi and allied war against the people of Yemen, flying as Al-Qaeda's air force against their enemies, the Houthis. Their bitter enemies. So, yes, at some point, a Yemeni is going to blow up something in the West, or somebody coordinated or sent by the Yemenis. Abdul Muttalib, I think, was from Niger or Nigeria or somewhere in West Africa, but had come by way of Yemen. Sooner or later, they're going to trace another attack to Yemen, and then they're going to tell you, yeah, they hate you because you're happy and free, and you let your daughter and sister go to junior college and vote in primary elections. And as long as you're happy, they'll never stop trying to kill you, so better give us your son to defend the rest of you. And maybe you will or maybe you won't buy it. It's going to be hard. I don't know. Isn't it hard? Shouldn't it be hard by now to pretend that history began yesterday or the day before yesterday, when even if the 20th century didn't happen, even if you deny the existence of the 1990s, the 80s and 70s before those, it's pretty hard to deny that the 2000 aughts took place, right? And that possibly bombing Al-Qaeda and backing Al-Qaeda in Yemen, in Libya, in Syria might could be a bad idea and create more enemies, could get Americans killed. You know? Might be the kind of thing that you might attribute terrorist reactions to later when they happen. You know what I mean? If you could remember that. Oh, yeah. America did have a war in Libya, right? Do you hear a Libyan blew something up? But we were bombing their country for a bunch of Al-Qaeda guys, right? And then now we're bombing Al-Qaeda guys there. At least occasionally they got British special forces who are over there supposedly fighting the Islamic State. I don't know who's really killing who over there. But I don't know. Maybe people will remember. At the time of September 11th, they couldn't remember the first Gulf War. They, I guess, never paid enough attention to know. Or remember Bill Clinton's pseudo-war against Iraq that lasted for 8 years straight, where they blockaded and bombed a million people to death.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it.
Yeah, we think the price is worth it. 500,000 children. Yeah, whatever, man. They're just Iraqis. They don't count. You can do what you want with them. The price is worth it for what? For a policy regime change against Saddam Hussein, who basically spent his whole day keeping Al-Qaeda down. Or, you know, Al-Qaeda-like guys down. Anyway. Don't be surprised when something blows up on one of these Christmases. And I'm not talking about the FBI entrapment jobs. I'm talking about actual terrorist attacks. It could happen. Your government seems to be making certain it does.